I want to wish you a happy holiday today. I want to give you a big happy Reformation Day to you on this first Sunday of November. I'm a few days late, so I'm very curious about how you each celebrated this important holiday of Reformation Day. I celebrated by giving candy out to my neighbor's kids all night last week. Halloween doubles as this lesser-known holiday of Reformation Day, same day. These are actually tied together. And this year was a big one. So this year was the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, you may have heard. This anniversary marks the day, 500 years and a couple of days ago, when Martin Luther nailed his 95-point thesis about religious reform to the door of the Wittenberg Catholic Church. Martin Luther, it's a big deal in religious history, really all of history, of course. But I want to tell you some things you may or may not know about him. He was quite the character, which you would expect from a guy who would write a paper and then nail it to his church's door. He was quite a character, really, in all of his life. I'm going to take you a little somewhere unexpected here for a moment. In his 40s, for instance, he suffered the whole decade from quite seriously debilitating constipation. And he's a very colorful man, and so he wrote in lots of his letters about this. This is like there's lots of material on this medical crisis of his. I'll spare you all the details other than to quote Luther himself in a letter, as he often wrote. He wrote, "My ass has become nasty." And sorry, kids, but this is like the way he would talk about it. He was a colorful man, and he didn't blame, as we might, his diet of like lots of beer and lots of sausages, not a lot of greens, but he blamed it straight on Satan. Like, he was in religious battle over this issue. So, but from this one like constipated Catholic seminary professor comes all of Protestantism. And I would say even Catholics would agree, looking back, a much-needed set of religious reforms and Renaissance Catholicism, too. Not only that, but some people have argued that out of Luther come the seeds for like the Enlightenment, this huge movement in world history, come the seeds of increased world literacy, come the seeds of the American and French revolutions, amongst other things. And whether you'd consider yourself Protestant, whether you'd consider yourself Catholic, or whether you wouldn't count yourself as either of those things, Luther was just a beautiful voice very often on the goodness of God. Read you some short quotations from his writing. He wrote, "The whole being of any Christian is faith and love. Faith brings the person to God, and love brings the person to people." It's a beautiful sentiment, right? He also wrote this, "God created the world out of nothing, and so long as we are nothing, he can make something out of us." Like, that's a killer quote to like put by your bedside, right? Like, any day you feel like nothing, like you're in the position for God to do something beautiful out of. One more from him. He wrote, "God writes the gospel not in the Bible alone, but also on trees and in the flowers and clouds and stars." Like, wow, for the 1500s, God could be found everywhere. It's good stuff, right? Where could God not be found? But unfortunately, Luther had his problems too. 3 years before his death, Luther was really angry that his ministry to Jewish communities where he lived hadn't been so successful as far as he could tell. People hadn't listened to him or done what he hoped they would do. And so he wrote a book about it, is what Luther did when he had something to say. This book was called On the Jews and Their Lies. And it's really as bad as it sounds. I'll quote it brief from it. This German priest wrote in that book, "Set fire to their synagogues or schools, and bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever see again a stone or cinder of them." He also wrote, "I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed, and all cash and treasure of silver and gold be taken from them and put aside for safekeeping." I hope this sounds absolutely chilling to you as it does to me. Luther didn't invent anti-Semitism, of course. He was in a long European tradition of that. But he did become the most famous theologian in a country that 400 years later birthed the Nazi Party that did the things that he wrote should be done, with the majority of the country's churches not standing in the way. Like, religion doesn't get much worse than this. Luther actually had no issue with violence generally, it appears. Emboldened by his rebellion against Catholic Church leadership, German peasants in his region rebelled against their economic masters. There's this Peasants' War, it was called. And at first, Luther advocated for peace. But when the peasants didn't listen, he wrote a text, as he would do again, entitled Against the Rioting Peasants. Against the Rioting Peasants, that was the name of his little book. And he said, these same peasants that were inspired by Luther, he wrote, "Let anyone who can smite, slay and stab them, secretly or openly. Just 20 years later, another Protestant Reformation leader, John Calvin, in neighboring Switzerland, took this thinking one step further and argued that not just political opponents should be killed, but your theological opponents as well, the people that disagree with you about what God's like and how God works in the world. He wrote, "Whoever shall now contend that it is unjust to put heretics and blasphemers to death, knowingly and willingly incur their guilt. If you don't kill them, you're just as bad as them. It is not human authority that speaks, it is God who speaks and prescribes a perpetual rule for his church. Churches forever should kill people that disagree with them about God." He got a chance to put this to test. During the 5 years that Calvin was magistrate of Geneva's city-state, Calvin oversaw 58 death sentences, including one of a longtime friend of his. And his friend's great crime was to take an early draft of Calvin's biggest work and to, you know, like you're writing a book, you give it to some friends and colleagues and ask for their feedback. His friend gave it back to him with all kinds of criticisms about what he didn't agree with. And so the result was that Calvin had him convicted of religious crimes, crimes like baptizing people at the wrong age. His friend, and he was convicted in that trial to sentence to death by burning. His friend pleaded for mercy, and he asked that he would be killed by beheading instead, because it would be far less painful. Calvin wouldn't have it, though, and his old buddy, his friend, was publicly tortured and killed in flames. It took a half an hour for him to die. It's pretty bad religion, too, isn't it? I hope you'd agree. As positive as some of the reformers' contributions to spirituality and religion were, many positive contributions, there was an awful lot of horrible, horrible stuff mixed up with that as well. Religion's a really complicated thing, isn't it? That's the point I'm trying to make here. I know a lot of us in this room would consider ourselves religious people. I know many of us in the room would not especially consider ourselves religious people, but I think here we are, gathered on a Sunday, in an old religious building, thinking about God and talking about God. So whether or not we want to call that activity religious, we're probably mincing words a little bit. In some way, at least today, we're broadly part of this story. And I think religion can take many forms. Some of it can seem to be more or less toxic to its participants and the world. Some of it can seem more or less fruitful to its participants and the world at large. But we're going to try and go big picture at this moment in history, this big 500th anniversary. And this month, I'm going to invite us to a conversation about what kind of religion we do or don't want to practice in our lives, in the world at large. Earlier this year, I saw a bumper sticker for this 500th anniversary of the Reformation. I saw it along Commonwealth Avenue on the campus of BU, out-of-state place, of course, but I thought, like, wow, this moment is like bumper sticker worthy. That particular bumper sticker, like 500th anniversary of Reformation, took things in the direction of Bible reading, had sort of a subnote on there, like let's get the Bible back or something, since the Reformation did lead to more widespread Bible reading in Europe. But I thought, I think we could celebrate the Reformation like the same way the Reformers did the original one, which is by continuing the best of their work and trying to rid ourselves of the worst, by ridding ourselves of bad forms of religion. Religion that diminishes God, that diminishes people, that diminishes the earth, just refusing to practice it anymore. And so this series will be in this month, and I hope the invitation to a conversation in our community is being called Let's Bad Religion Die. There's a second half to our series title, though, because the goal here isn't ultimately to tear something down, it's to renovate. Just like any time you live in a house for a really long time, like it needs fixing up, it needs change at some point. And so the goal here is to create something new that will work today. And so the second half of our series, which doesn't make the slide here, is called New Ways of Being with God in the World. And the goal isn't to address like things way out far away from us, like there's some kind of enemy we're against. Like the goal is to look personally. Like are there forms of religion in us and in our friends that don't serve us particularly well that God needs to replace with something more fruitful? And the goal is positive. Like, what are ways of being with God in the world that are worth pursuing? Asking, like, could the future of religion itself be under reform in our times? I think it is. And is this maybe a gift and not just something we might need to be afraid of? Is this something that Jesus is, in fact, doing on the earth today? I think it is. I hope it is. I really hope, one of the bigger picture hopes of my life and my work is that Jesus is doing something new in world spiritual and religious practice in our times, that we can get to be a part of it, like however big or small our role might be. And so we'll look forward to these big picture things this month, but as always, we'll start in today's talk by looking backward as well to Jesus' teaching and his words, to the Bible's testimony about Jesus, see where that takes us. There's an intriguing moment in John's memoirs of Jesus we've been reading this fall. Totally lost my train of thought. Give me one second. What I want to say about John. Do I have notes about this? Anyway, I don't know quite where I was going with that, but we're going to see where this passage takes us, and we'll see, like, as spiritual or religious people, whichever kind of phrase you prefer, like, what does it have to say to us? What does it have to say about the future of religion in our times? We'll read part of this excerpt, the first part that you have in your programs. It goes like this. Very truly I tell you, anyone who does not enter the sheepfold by the gate but climbs in by another way is a thief and a bandit. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. They will not follow a stranger, but they will run from him because they do not know the voice of strangers. Jesus used this figure of speech with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus tells us agrarian stories he liked to do sometimes. Jesus lived in the countryside. He tells a story about gates and sheep and thieves and a shepherd. It's a little smaller scale than what I'd expect in a farming story. The shepherd's able to get his sheep out of the pen by calling them individually, like name by name. Very quaint, lovely, pastoral story. But this is farming first century style, sort of intimate, not large industrial scale like we'd see today. I'm glad that John says, though, that Jesus' friends had no idea what he was talking about. Because if this was all I had, I'd be a little confused too. Like, Jesus, where's this story going? But Jesus continues. He tries to kind of unpack the metaphors of this story. He says this. So again, Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and bandits, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters by me will be saved and will come in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand, who is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and runs away, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. The hired hand runs away because the hired hand does not care for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as my Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that do not belong to this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd." I don't know about you, but the whole gate section isn't immediately crystal clear to me. Because best I can tell, though, the sheep, even though they're still sheep, are also people now, and Jesus is very protective of them. There are other people who want to take people and eat them or sell them or do whatever bandits might do to sheep. But Jesus starts his teaching saying, "I am not like that. I'm not a thief." He repeats, like, I am a gate. I protect people. I'm the way to safety as the sheep come in through the gate. And I'm the way to nourishment as the sheep go back out through that gate. Only good things ever happen around me, through me, because of me. And then he takes this analogy home for people because he has a name for all these good things that sheep get as they walk in and out through him. He calls this abundant life. And then the second half, Jesus says, not only am I not a thief, but I'm also not like that summer employee you hire at minimum wage and hope good things will come out of that. I'm not a hired hand. I think about this, and I think I was a hired hand once. I know what this feels like. When I was in graduate school, I worked at UPS. I was awake in the middle of the night in this huge warehouse up in Linfield where all these beautiful cardboard boxes that come to your door get sorted throughout the middle of the night. We'd take boxes off of one conveyor belt, put them on another in the right sort of zip code container. It was exhausting work. It was in the middle of the night, heavy boxes, hours on end. So sometimes when you're doing something tough, you got to grin and bear it and, you know, fight your way through. And sometimes you just got to get smart and, like, get out of there. So that's what I did. I quit UPS, like the hired hand that I was, and I found another job. And this job, I was a cashier at a small health food and sports nutrition store. And usually I was the only one in the store, which is why it no longer exists. But now and then a customer would come in. And we had some, to my mind, strange customers. One guy once came in asking about an herb called saw palmetto, which we carried, but like everything else we carried, I knew nothing about. So I told him, "I don't really know anything about that." And he said, "Really?" And he looked at me, and I had receding hairline back then. I still had hair then, but it was on the way out. And he looked at me and he thought, you should use this stuff too. I was like, really? He's like, it'll make your hair grow back. I was like, well, this guy had less hair than I did, so he wasn't like a convincing advertisement for the product. But I was like, really, it will? And he said, yeah, and he leaned over, like way over the counter, right in my face, shoved his scalp in my face, you know, pointed out, I saw these little like three or four scraggly hairs just peeking out, hanging on for dear life. He's like, all this is new growth. Like, you could have this too. And I'm thinking, like, out of my way, please, right? I think I said something to him like, congratulations, I think it's in aisle three. Right? But really, I'm thinking like off the counter, please, like practically out of my lap, because I want to be left alone. So normally, again, we didn't have many customers in the store, and I like this because I would sit at the cash register reading or studying and hope no one would enter the store. Or maybe just enough people would come into the store so that it would stay open until the end of the year so I could get paid to do my homework and my studying. The only time I got motivated as an employee was like the time of the month when I got to scan the shelves for expiring foodstuffs so I could bring home like free protein powders and organic pancake mixes that we weren't allowed to sell anymore. I was very much the hired hand in this job. Absolutely clear to me, I was there to take as much as I get out of it, not at all to give. And Jesus says, thankfully, I know what that's like too. I see you, Steve. I am not like that with people. I am a good shepherd. He says, I have ownership in this. This is my life. I'm dedicated. I take care of the sheep. I will put myself in between the sheep and any possible harm. He says, I'll lay down my life for them. And I think not generally as a group. Like in theory, I'll lay down my life for all of them. But he says, for one of them, for each of them, I will do this. Because they're my people. They're my sheep. I know their name. It's like they're my friends, the feeling we get. I think, doesn't this sentiment from Jesus sound so very different from at least the worst of the attitude we saw in Calvin and Luther? And I think this is no accident, because this discourse of Jesus with his friends, John believed that this was pretty consciously anti-religious. That graduate school I worked in when I was at UPS and at the health food store was a seminary to train future Bible experts and theologians and pastors. And one of the courses I took while I was there was a course on reading and interpreting the New Testament. We were learning first century Greek, and then we were using that tool to spend a semester reading different texts and from the New Testament and writing papers about what they mean. I didn't always like seminary very much, but I really liked this class. And so when we got this assignment to write a paper on the 9th chapter of John and this beginning part of the 10th chapter I read to you today, I really put my all into it. I worked my tail off sitting at that cash register in the health food store, and I think I cared about this paper enough that I actually brought the work home to do my free time as well. And I wrote such a great paper, I thought. But then I got it back, and I got an A-. I thought this was like the one perfect paper I've written. Like, what's up with the minus? Then I read the professor's comments, and he pointed out that I'd missed this one key thing about the context of the passage. It was kind of a trick on his part, because the thing he said I had missed was the last word before the passage we studied and the first phrase after the passage we studied. I thought that's kind of a dirty trick to hold people accountable for stuff that isn't in the assignment. But when I sort of read his comments, I got, like this teaches me something. I'm grateful for this. Because what the professor had expected me to notice that I hadn't was that the 8th chapter of John ends in the temple, and actually the last word of that chapter is the word temple. And immediately after this discourse we're reading today, Jesus is back in the temple again. And so the point of this section for John is that this is what's happening while Jesus is outside the temple. This is Jesus beyond the religion of his day, and thus it contains this kind of subtle critique of religion. It's John showing us how religion has to change, and how Jesus is doing this. It's this passage, a contrast of what Jesus has to offer and the worst of traditional religious practice. Maybe just in his day, but I don't think so. I think always. Notice what Jesus doesn't have to say about spirituality and religion when he talks about the gate and the shepherd. Jesus doesn't say anything about coercion, which you would actually expect a shepherd to use coercion. But Jesus is a shepherd who calls his sheep by name, who walks in front of them, he says. And because they recognize and trust his voice, they follow him. Think about all the other tools you could have associated with a shepherd, right? A stick to beat his sheep, nothing about that here. Could have dogs to corral them down and chase them in. In our times, it could have been electric fences and prods to keep these sheep in line. You can keep them in tiny little cages and just bring their food to them. You don't even have to send them out into pasture at all. But this wouldn't have worked to picture Jesus, because as a leader, he practices no coercion, no control, no pressure, no using shame and guilt and behavioral levers to manipulate people. He treats people well, and as they learn his good voice, they will willingly follow of their own volition, he says. We had a talk about this, talk about coercion and religion in a class of pastors I was in once. And the conversation was how religious people on occasion try to get the whole society to live by the tenets of morals of our religion. And people seem to agree this kind of societal conversion, John Calvin style, doesn't work really well. It gives religion a bad name. We had a consensus in our group that religious groups probably shouldn't try to use our capital to control non-religious people. But there was a real interest in our group of how pastors could use coercion as a tool within our churches. As if part of what people sign up for when they join a church is to have its leaders tell them what's right and to use all the tools at their disposal to tell them that they need to do it, to get them to do it. Persuasion, of course, but also pressure, even punishment when necessary. And the idea was like, why not if you have to, if you know what's best for people? But Jesus, I think, here and really throughout his record, and says he does not lead but by coercion. That's why I was so overjoyed when a person who's new at Reservoir over the past year, I said, you know what strikes me about this community? She said, all I hear is kindness. Like, I'm keep waiting for the shoe to drop. I'm like the not kind part of God. She'd had some religious experience under her belt significantly that was different. And she said, there's nothing but kindness here. I like that. I thought, I like that too. Because leadership at Reservoir is dedicated to inviting people to follow Jesus. And this is not like a no goal or passive enterprise or whatever, but to do so never through manipulation or shame or guilt or even subtle coercion. So I thought, wow, I'm glad people are noticing. That was like a great feedback to hear. You'll also hear that Jesus has no place for violence of any kind in religion. Violence really is just a step beyond coercion, right? To do emotional or soul violence to someone in the way you demean or shame or control them. Some of us have experienced that in life, different places, including religious places. And certainly, Jesus says, there's no kind of place for the kind of physical violence in religion that Luther and Calvin both recommended. In Jesus' teaching, he says, violence is the tool of thieves. Jesus doesn't use violence. He delivers people from violence. He protects them. He has no aim to make his followers violent either. Sheep are quite obviously not war animals. Obviously, violence has been a huge part of the expression of religion in pretty much any culture that's known religion. It still is today. And you know, despite the narrative going on in our country at the moment, there isn't any one religion that takes the lead on this or has claim to this problem. Islam and Christianity, for instance, have both had significant problems with violence in just about every century that each of these religions has existed. And you see violence in the expression of other religions as well. You see it, for instance, certain streams of Hindu nationalism, which you think, wow, Hinduism seems like a peace-loving religion, but the violence is there too. Jesus, though, says there's no place in spirituality for any kind of violence or even for any kind of coercion. It's antithetical to who he is and how he wants to be followed and known in the world. But I think there's one more critique before I take us to the positive place in the wrap-up that Jesus is getting at that's connected to coercion and violence as well. Michael Gunger is a frontman for a band called Gunger. He was on the stage a few weeks back as part of the liturgist gathering. He released a song last year which was called Let Bad Religion Die. So hearing that was another inspiration for the series. And in it, he talks about the awful religious legacy of violence, historically and presently. But there's also a verse in the song that says this: if all the outsiders are wrong, if your questions don't belong, if your doubt is called a sin, and you are not to search within, let it go. Open your eyes. Let bad religion die. I think often underneath its tendency to manipulate or to coerce, religion can have a tribe loyalty that reinforces a suspicion of outsiders. Religion can serve to bond like-minded people together in a scary, unstable, volatile world and give a sense that we've found the high ground. So other people need to join us there, or we need to at least keep other people at bay, keep their kind of corrupting influence off of us. And in this brand of religion, too many questions, too many doubts, Too many outsiders are all dangerous. They disrupt the tribe. But do you notice how untribal Jesus is here? Again, not just here, but everywhere. He says to his disciples, I have other sheep that do not belong to this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. From a New Testament perspective, this is likely a story about Jews and Gentiles. So at the very least, Jesus is letting his first century Jewish followers know that this won't just be their ethnic, national, kind of cultural, religious story. Jesus is not their possession, but he's there for the whole world, Gentiles included. And in the New Testament, this Gentile reach is ever expanding. It goes places that I think Jesus' original disciples did not expect it to go. It becomes clear that this too is for the enemies of Jesus and the enemies of Jesus' culture. This too is for gender and sexual outsiders. This too is for powerful people of influence, even resented powerful people. And this experience of faith in Jesus is certainly too for the most marginalized or most on the outskirts, most oppressed people as well. Jesus' first century followers are continually shocked at just how wide this everyone's story goes. This is why we practice faith that we call, term for it we use around here, centered set. We want people, I want me, to recognize the voice of Jesus, to have Jesus lead us to an experience of God that is kind and protective and nourishing, that is the power, like real power, to work within us to produce what Jesus calls eternal life, abundant life, profound love, limitless hope, deep, deep courage. And we want people to take that journey for themselves, to really go there with our questions and our doubts, with our personalities and our needs, known by Jesus, our good shepherd, who doesn't coerce us but keeps calling us, inviting us forward. The goal isn't like a tribal collective to conform you, even to conform you subtly into a loyal tribe. The goal is that everyone who wants can find God and find more life, and to do that in accepting and safe, joyful community. This is like our project here, Reservoir Brand, spirituality and religion, you could call it, because I think we're confident that we're at least part of something that we could call Jesus Brand spirituality, Jesus Brand religion. We have our own language for that here, but we obviously didn't make this stuff up. We're obviously not the only ones practicing it. It's again my deep, deep hope that Jesus is growing this kind of expression of spiritual practice throughout the earth. Because we need a way out of coercion and violence in telltale hallmarks of religion. People are fed up with this. It hasn't gone away, obviously, but people are tired of religion as a tool to control people and to hurt people. And people want a faith that's tied to genuine healing and renewal, like not theoretically, but personally lived, experienced by each participant. There's a hunger, I think, in our own country, and I think it's throughout the world as well, to see if there's something to the goodness and reality of Jesus beyond at least the worst we've known of religion, beyond the kind of tribe loyalty that I think has seen its day. So the rest of our series, we're going to keep imagining how this could be so, and also looking at ways this is already so, like how God is doing these things around us. Next week, you'll meet a prominent Muslim journalist who thinks the teaching of Jesus might be the great hope for Islam in the world today. I'm like so intrigued by this new friend of mine. Our church's friend, Carl Medeiros, introduced me to this gentleman named Mustafa Akyol, a Turkish journalist who's in residence at Wellesley College right now last year, over email. We've become friends, though, and he's looking forward to talking on the stage with us all about Jesus, and we're tied in our talk, following the non-Christian Jesus. I'll share some things I think about Jesus. He'll share some things he thinks about Jesus. And we'll both say, like, Jesus is the way. Not exactly in the same way, but it's pretty interesting. We'll do a book event at Porter Square that afternoon. You'll see that in your program. It's probably going to be kind of crowded, so, you know, you can get them here. But if you have a friend who'd be interested in this, like, non-Christian and Muslim Jesus and Jesus beyond religion, you could feel free to let him know about the Porter Square books event, too. But he'll have his books available for sale to be signed here, too, next week. The week after, God willing, my friend Mustafa would say, inshallah, like, kind of, if it works out, my friend Kieran Martin will speak with me. Kieran's not 100% sure she can make it this month, but she wants to. Kieran's story, she runs a sustainable development agency in Delhi that we work with, so she's been here before. But she'll share more of her story. She hasn't shared her yet. Kieran grew up Hindu and then learned to follow Jesus. And we're going to talk together about the Jesus we found wooing us and people we know, Jesus that works change sort of from the inside out within whatever cultural context we're in, like not from the outside in. And then over Thanksgiving weekend, I'll talk with one of our members here, my good friend Roger Dewey. Roger's lived a life of pretty dynamic faith, and today in his 70s, he and his wife Claire are like still on the journey, still looking forward to like how they can trust Jesus in the next chapter of their life. And so we'll talk about how we all can kind of embrace that adventure too. Then the following weekend, the first week of December, we'll start our Christmas season we call Light in the Darkness here. Last year we did what I think was a really memorable and beautiful participatory liturgy. We did a day without a sermon and did this thing around our laments, our griefs, our pains, and our hopes. So we won't repeat that exact experience, but we'll again do a sort of non-sermon, a participatory, kind of artful liturgy. This time it'll be inspired by the way we tell the Christmas story to our children here at Reservoir, and we'll be doing some storytelling and seeking to find ourselves in our lives and that story as well. So I think it'll be a pretty memorable, powerful way to start December and the Christmas season. That's just some of the flavor of how we'll be exploring these things this next month. All of this, again, is just out of our desire to practice Jesus brand spirituality, Jesus brand religion, to see where that takes us, where that takes the world at large, with no coercion, no violence, no tribalism, just winsome, inviting experiences of community and renewal that lead to more and more life. I will keep that up next year, just a couple more tastes of things to come. We're starting to plan our season we call 40 Days of Faith, which we do just before Easter. 2018, we'll take a tour, I think, through one of the Bible's least read and craziest books, the last one in the whole Bible. And we'll do it with a focus on living as children of God in a time of empire, like seeking to follow Jesus into more and more life, even in chaotic, violent, turbulent times. I think all of us feel like we live in those kind of times. And our hope is to offer, too, that brand of spiritual religious practice more and more to our whole city and our whole region. This is why our board approved that new position that you heard Ivy talking about. We're like, you know, it's time to take a risk and staff one of our church's core dreams, which is that our spiritual practice would be accessible and available really easily and really broadly to anyone who's non-church-going in our city and in the cities around us and in our region. So we're staffing a position to kind of sow into our hope to be growing, not to increase our power to do anything toxic, but because we're eager to be part of a good gift Jesus is giving us. And Jesus is doing within religion, sometimes outside of religion altogether. Is Jesus inviting more and more people to hear the voice of God and find great life and hope in that? I'm running a little long, so I want to wrap up with just three quick tips about looking for healthy ways of being with God in the world. And there'll be more of this to come over the next month, of course, but just three tips here. The first is to pursue the life of Jesus with other people, like other real people. Obviously, I'd tell you to stay away from people and leaders that seem mean and violent and manipulative and coercive, but the alternative to that is not solitary, isolated faith. Jesus is gathering flocks, to use his metaphor, like people that can enjoy our lives and the life of God with us together. So if you have at least one friend who follows Jesus or is trying to, and you're a person who would like to try to follow Jesus, try to let that friendship be a spiritual one. Actually, it takes a little bit of proactive effort, but to let that friendship be one which you would ask someone to pray for you or to invite prayer or to talk about in the context of that friendship, like what it is that you're learning about God or how you do or don't experience God in your life. And if you like this church and find it helpful, that's obviously a huge caveat. This is not to anyone who doesn't like this church or doesn't find it helpful. Blessed be your life, whatever small your involvement is here, please. But if you do like it and do find it helpful, then like kind of give yourself to it. Consider making a preset decision for weekly worship involvement here and for regular community group involvement too. This isn't, again, because we're trying to get you to do anything in particular. I don't get any bonus for how many people are in the seats on Sundays or how many people go to groups. It doesn't work that way. It's just that showing up again and again puts us in position where we can hear from and follow Jesus together, and we can share that gift to other people that are trying to check it out or experience it for themselves. Kind of we can't do that alone. It only happens if we're showing up. Secondly, steadfastly resist tribalism, coercion, and judgment. When you see it coming, just walk away. This, by the way, is my big tip for people who need to move and find another church. They're leaving this city. They're like, where should I go to church? Like, is there like a Reservoir in the city where I'm going? I'm like, probably not. There aren't that many of us. Like, we're just, you know, one little church. But, you know, what do you do? What do you look for? I said, well, find a church that talks about Jesus, whether it's exactly the way you're used to hearing from here or not, And then just don't go somewhere that seems particularly judgy or coercive, that seems like they have the market on all truth, they think, because that'll bite you eventually, one way or another. And I think in what we read to, and who we trust, and who we listen to, this is actually a decent filter as well, to not seep yourselves in religious toxins. Don't try to become the kind of person that takes the high ground every time, that tries to persuade and judge other people that you are always on the side of the right. And I need to work on that too. And lastly, be as persistent and dedicated and as intense as possible about recognizing and listening to the voice of Jesus. I say, like, take this project really seriously, like, with all you've got in your life. This is, after all, the positive point of all this. For Jesus to move from a character on the page of the Bible or from artwork in the institutions around us to a personal voice of life for us. This has been the best of Jesus-centered faith traditions. Again, for centuries, unbroken. From the first days on through Luther and the crazy reformers, and right now into today, into our own age of spiritual renewal and reformation. Again and again, people have found Jesus to be beautiful and compelling and a source of love and power and courage and hope that we really need and that our friends in the world really need as well. So don't stop or sort of take a breather on your own journey, however far it's taken to you at this point. Like, practice the things the community invites you to every week that seem good to you. Talk about where you are hearing from Jesus or want to hear from Jesus with your friends. Look to meet Jesus here in worship and in communion, on your own when you talk to Jesus, or really wherever you go in your life as you look for the God that can be found around you, experienced by you in all things. I'm going to practice that for a moment right now as we transition into our communion and worship. And so I'll make a quick announcement about prayer, and then we'll take a beat of prayer together as our band comes up. The announcement is just that after we pray now, for those of you that would like more prayer and for someone to pray for you in particular, we'd love to offer you that. We'll have people on the back right throughout the rest of service. They are simply to pray for you, and they'd be happy to pray for you for anything. You can tell them why you want prayer or not. When they met together this morning, they also had a sense of particular things God might want to do to encourage some people in the room. And we pass those on to you in case they encourage you to have someone pray for you. If you have physical problems in your right knee, your stomach, your heart, or in your breathing, they would love to pray that you could experience some of God's power or healing for you. And if you have the more emotional needs of just feeling like in a big state of confusion or feel like you're running away from God, but somehow you wish you weren't, they would love to pray for you for that as well. So again, if any of that resonates, you just like prayer, they'll be here in a minute while we're singing the rest of the service. But let's take a minute together to pray as well. Join me. Jesus, certainly in the rest of our service, but even as we transition in a moment of silence right now, I would like to experience you as my friend and leader and protector and guide that speaks to me my name and I recognize your voice. And so I pray, God, that if you'd like to get that experience continuing or starting for any of us, we'll take a moment of silence and ask Jesus, would you like to call us by name in some way? Do you have something to speak to us right now? Just give this a minute. Jesus, thank you that we can hear you sort of in what goes on in our minds and imaginations, we pray. That we can hear you through things we see around us. Thanks for the encouragement you just gave me about the fun and gentle ways you seek our attention. Pray, Jesus, for those of us that felt like we were in communion somehow with the living God just now, that you'd give us more of that. You continue to draw us closer to you. For those of us that haven't had that experience yet today, We pray that that would be ours as well this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.